Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the Goalkeepers Union podcast with me, Matt Beadle, and the very well-educated voice of goalkeeping, Richard Lee.
I love how you find something new every week. Right.
Well, you're an educated chap, aren't you? You've got your A-levels?
Got my GCSEs.
GCSEs.
Of course, we left school at 16, but I did get a degree.
In?
Media and journalism.
Oh, nice. When was that?
I did that at Staffordshire University alongside my career, yes.
Thought about doing something with that degree, mate, or not?
Very
not
funny. Very funny.
Well, look, there's a reason I mention education, because big story involving a goalkeeper, Wayne Hennessey, over the past couple of weeks is the Nazi salute that he's actually been let off for by the FA. Now, a report on the BBC website said that the FA panel found Hennessey showed a lamentable degree of ignorance about Adolf Hitler, fascism and the Nazi regime. So he's also submitted photographs just to, if anybody doesn't know the story, I'm pretty sure everybody does, but Max Meyer was on an Instagram story and Wayne Hennessey was in the back of a picture and appeared to be doing what was perceived as a Nazi salute. Yeah. He came out and said he had no idea what a Nazi salute was. He since, according to Roy Hodgson, is now desperate to learn about World War II and Adolf Hitler. That's brilliant. I'm not going to say whether we believe him or we don't believe him, but what was your take on that particular incident?
I found it interesting, and obviously today's guest, who we'll talk about shortly, is Andy Lonergan. The reason I'll talk about this now is we have interviewed him, not to spoil the magic of this podcast, but we have interviewed him already, and he talked about how he focused quite heavily on football when he was very young and didn't necessarily concentrate at school. There's a couple of things here. So one is, do I think he knew what he was doing? I think he did. In fact, I know. If you're in a football changing room, I liken it to being in play school. Within those four walls of a changing room in a football environment, you can say and do whatever you want and nobody cares. If anything, the crazier the thing you do, the more you get admired. And I've got images of George Saville now at Middlesbrough doing some unthinkable things. But to us, it's hilarious because nobody takes offence at anything. Offence being something of a choice. No one took offence. So you can do whatever you want. So something like that, for instance, in a changing room, no one bats an eyelid. Of course, the moment you do it outside of those four walls and you do it in the general public, then you have to answer and you're responsible for your actions. The second part of it, in terms of education, firstly, do I think he was going to cause offence or wanted to cause offence? Absolutely not. Like, whether he lacks intelligence or not is irrelevant. His intentions weren't to cause offence. He would have thought it was funny if that's what he was doing. So the second part to it, when it comes to education, did I focus in school? Not that much, because at the time, certainly my last couple of years at school, I wanted to be a footballer. Now, most footballers, and this is the example I give, when I went into the youth team at Watford, 16 years old, we had, I think, 10 progress to the youth team. And if you didn't get a C in English, maths or science, you needed to redo it until you got a C. So out of the 10, how many do you think had to redo one of those exams?
Out of 10?
Yeah. We only had to get three Cs at GCSE level.
I'm guessing it's a high number.
It's a high number. It was 7 or 8, if I remember rightly, had to redo those. Why was that? Because as of the age of 14, right or wrong, they wanted to be a footballer and they focused everything. So do you think they're focusing in history? Do you think they're focusing in biology? Of course they're not. All they've got on their mind is football. Now, is that an excuse? No. Ignorance isn't an excuse, and you do need a certain level of general knowledge. I fully agree with that. But do I think that Wayne Hennessey meant to cause any offence? Absolutely not. And the way that it's been dealt with, of course, it doesn't look brilliant on him. And I'm sure he does feel bad now. Now that he's learned a little bit more as to what it means and how it may have offended people, I'm sure he'll want to make things right as quick as he can. And I feel a bit bad for him that he will get a little bit of stick for this.
It's the management of these situations sometimes, isn't it, which makes things worse. The fact that he came out and said, I didn't know what a Nazi salute was, that's what people struggle with. Mm. Because, you know, he's 32, I think 32, 33, to not know what a Nazi salute is unbelievable. How do you not know what that is? That's what we learn at school. And I understand that, you know, your mind is focused on football, but that's just almost like common knowledge.
But no, but there are a lot of people out there that just don't. I'll be honest, I haven't read one word about Brexit. There you go. I have got no clue what's going on, and I don't care as much as I should. And I know I should, because it's going on around us and it will impact me. I'm very aware of that, but I can't impact it. I've got no interest. So I've just made that decision. Now, right or wrong, you could tell me the most basic thing about Brexit. I won't know. And that's my point. So it goes back to most footballers. If you ask them a question about history, do they know we had world wars? I think so. I'd like to think so. Do they know any details about those world wars? Of course they don't. Mm. The majority don't. Like, as much as we give footballers stick for being thick, footballers aren't thick. IQ-wise, they'll be pretty high. And actually, to play the game of football, you need to be intelligent. There's a good book out. I forget who wrote it, but Thick Footballers Are Dead, I think it's called, because you have to have a level of intelligence to see the patterns of play and how the game progresses and develops in order to be a top footballer. And if you're going to be a top footballer, you need a certain level of intelligence. Do you have book smarts? Most of them don't. Mm.
So it's that common sense with a lot of footballers. Mm. And it's interesting because you've said on this podcast on a few occasions that goalkeepers are generally more intelligent than outfield players.
Yeah, they are to an extent in terms of they have to calculate situations. You have to be able to see what's happening before it's happening. You have to predict things. Is the ball being played through? Is it playing wide? Are your defenders marked up, etc., etc.? So you have to see 2 or 3 seconds ahead. It's like a game of chess. You're seeing the moving parts and you need to know what is going to happen next. So you have to have a certain type of brain in order to do that. Again, it's got nothing to do with general knowledge. I hold my hands up for all the things that I do at the moment. And obviously, look, we're doing some brilliant things with Goalkeepers Union. And, you know, I've got several other businesses and what have you. My general knowledge is still poor, very poor, because it's not my interest. I'd like to think that I've got a decent enough level of things like that. But there'll be so many people out there that won't, or they won't know the ramifications of doing that kind of a signal in public and what people might make of it. Again, does it make it right or wrong? It is what it is. I mean, he's learnt the hard way. And I'm sure he's not the only footballer that doesn't know exactly what that means and how it might cause offence to someone. Unfortunately for Wayne, he's been caught doing it and he's having to face the consequences.
And its circumstances as well. With this particular incident, the fact that Max Meyer is German, the fact that anti-Semitism right now, I mean, it's a massive issue all the time, but right now it's really, really topical. It's very taboo. But the pictures were fascinating because he's doing that in the pictures. Mm. And the fact that he presented that as evidence and they've worked for him because he is doing that exact gesture.
Yeah, yeah. And I've seen the pictures of him playing, which is bizarre. This is true. I mean, look, it is what it is now. It's done. It'd be interesting to see how much stick he does get. I think this will blow over reasonably soon in terms of how we can learn from it going forward. Look, there is a lot going on at the moment in the press, which is good in terms of raising awareness. It gets us talking about it, and we all learn. The more that we talk about these kind of subjects, we're all learning. So as much as Wayne Hennessy might be the one that's having to take the brunt of it, there is a positive to it because it has brought the subject up. And again, a lot of people will learn a lot of stuff they might not necessarily have known beforehand, which they will know now. And I think for most footballers, just a warning that ignorance isn't necessarily the way forward. And I know he's obviously got away with this or got off with this one, but certainly for most footballers, a level of common sense, a level of general knowledge is required.
Absolutely. Well, what do you think? Let us know via all the usual social channels. Rich, do you want to let people know what the social channels are?
I should know what the social channels are, but this is a good example of me not paying attention because this isn't my job, it's your job.
Absolutely brilliant. On Twitter at GK Union, on Instagram at GK Union Official. Just search GK Union on Facebook or drop us an email. hello@goalkeepersunion.net.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
This week's guest is a man who made his debut as a 16-year-old at Preston. He's since racked up more than 400 games as a goalkeeper with clubs including Leeds, Bolton, Wolves, Fulham, and now Middlesbrough. And here's to you, Andrew Lonergan. Welcome to the Goalkeepers Union podcast.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Lovely to have you here. Now, just to confirm, it's Andrew, right? Not Andy, because a lot of media reports and your name over the years has been Andy Lonergan, but I believe you prefer to be called Andrew.
My mum is the one that gets the ump a bit. Tell him it's Andrew, and I'm like, I gave up in about 2002. I'm like, call me whatever you want. Well, like I said, I'm Lonners to everyone, so that'll do me.
Lonna's perfect. It's funny how this happens with footballers, because Andy Cole did the same thing. After years of being a top flight footballer, in the latter stage of his career, he decided to go, actually, by the way, it's Andrew. It's not Andy Cole. It was like, well, you should have mentioned that when you were scoring 40 goals a season and got a mega money move to Man United.
Well, the thing is, you have that, but then within the football circles, everybody has a nickname. So I was probably one of the only ones who didn't, because Richard Lee doesn't really lend itself to actually having a decent nickname. But every other... I mean, you think in a change room, Lonna's, I'm sure that you're the same. And in fact, you've always been Lonna's to me for the last 20-odd years. I've never known you as anything different. But everybody has a nickname.
You were just Rich, weren't you? Just Rich.
I know.
So boring.
You know, so boring.
Yeah. It's not the best, is it? At school, everyone called me Andrew. But when you get into football, you're just happy that people know you by any name, aren't you? So you're just like, yeah, go ahead, whatever you want. Hey,
as long as it's not Keeper. That was the only one I struggled with, when you just get called Keeper.
Do you know what? I was listening to one of your podcasts and you mentioned it. Yeah. And I was thinking, you know, if a new player comes, and it's difficult for new players, and... or you go to a new club and they shout Keeper. I've been on loan at Rochdale, and first session, a couple of the younger lads, were shouting Keeper for the five-a-side, and I'm like, I just won't pass them the ball. I'm not a keeper. You know, if you don't know my name, you're not getting the ball. Lads clean through one goal, he's shouting Keeper, and I'm just like, you're not having it.
Love it.
Well, yeah. Lonna's. So we'll do Lonna's. A customary start with most podcasts we do. You fall into a great category of goalkeepers that have scored goals. We won't dwell on this one because I understand that you weren't that enamoured with the goal itself, but it was slightly different to other goals we've seen goalkeepers scored, because looking at it on YouTube, and we'll post it on our Twitter at GK Union, it was a half volley. It floated, but it sort of trickled over Kevin Pressman. It was for Preston against Leicester at the time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. It was that long ago. It was a half volley, and I don't think I've kicked an half volley since about 2006. So it's like it's gone out of fashion. People bring it up still now, and it's one of them. It doesn't bother me. I didn't care at the time that I'd scored. Obviously, it was important because we got a point. But to say I meant it, I just tried to kick it in them days, distribution, kick it as far as you can. So I just put my foot through it, bounced over the centre half's head, and the sun, it was a really low sun. It was really difficult. And I just see Kevin Pressman sort of get under the ball with his son, and next thing, I trickled over the line. I'm like, oh, scored a goal. Well,
that was it. I always remember you always had, you know, we'll touch on this shortly. Obviously, we had our, I think it was under-18s England together, didn't we, where I came on as a substitute for you at Upton Park, if I remember rightly, and we will touch on that. But that was one thing that always struck me when we were younger, because it was very different then. We're talking, you know, 15 years ago or so, when it wasn't about playing into midfield, playing to fullbacks, playing to wingers. It was get it forward, and the further forward you could get it, the more beneficial it would be for the team. And you always had that. You always had a lot of distance on your kicks from both the ground and out your hands.
Yeah, it was something that I really had to work on. When I first got in the England setup, I was playing... The school years fall differently, don't they? So I was playing in the England age group in year 10 at school with year 11s. And then when I was in year 11, the lads were first year YT, so I was always catching up. So I worked a lot on my kicking, but it really was just kick it as far as you can. And ideally, not down the middle. So you just aim to drop it over the fullback, which is something you don't see too much of nowadays.
Looking at it, the half volley, to get good distance and a good connection on a half volley takes quite a lot of training, right, to perfect that technique. So you spent all this time perfecting a half volley technique, and all of a sudden it's out the window, and now it's all about the side volley.
It is, yeah, and it's strange because every day in training we do half volleys at each other, and we can all do them, we can all hit them wherever we want, and it just comes to a game, and it's just like the margin for error on a half volley. You know, if you miskick a volley, it's still going to get the halfway line. If you shank an half volley, could go to the centre forward's feet. So it's a weird one. It's a bit of a trend as well. I remember when I was injured, I had 2 years pretty much out of the game, and I was watching a lot of football, and that's when the side volley come in. And I was thinking, I'm going to do that when I get back. And I wouldn't call mine a side volley. I'd call mine a bit of a hybrid between an up and under and a side volley. Not flexible enough to do the side.
You've said it there, it's almost out of fashion, I guess, because it was... That was it. I remember growing up, and not that he's that much older than us, but Van der Sar. Like, Van der Sar had this incredible half volley. And I remember when I played against him and being the other end and watching him pick out wingers, forwards, and it made a lot of sense. But when the side volley first came in, it was almost seen as being a bit fancy, because the risk with the side volley is that you duck hook it into the ground, which is the big danger, or you slice it the other way and you get no distance. Yeah. So there is still a lot of risk with the side volley. And I remember when it first came in, you kind of saw it. I thought that would just be a fad. I never thought it would really stick. And I thought the half volley would be the way forward. But the way in which the technique has developed now, and you can see the keepers that are keeping it head height the whole way. I personally think if you're not doing that as a kid, it's very hard. I was the same as you. I tried to develop it sort of later into my career, but I could never get the consistency or get the technique. And I think, I don't know if it's hips, flexibility, getting the power, the technique. I could never quite get the side volley to the point of where you see a lot of these goalkeepers doing it now, where they're able to keep it head height for 50, 60, 70 yards.
Yeah, it's definitely something you need to be brought up with. It's like they're playing out from the back now. If you were still playing, Rich, you'd be in the same boat as me. You can do it, but you weren't brought up with it, so it's not natural to you. You know, we can all do it, but it's just, I don't know about you, Rich, but I'm safety first. If there's any doubt, I'm not giving it them. But you get managers who are giving them. And you see the lads, they're looking, I don't want it. But you're getting peppered to give it to them. It's a tough one. But the young lads coming through, that's all their play. You know, if you play an under-23s game as a senior pro, you don't even have to wear a pair of studs because you never kick the ball off the halfway line. You're just passing it around.
Yeah, it's true.
So it's, I don't know whether that's a phase, a trend or what, but, you know, the game has changed a hell of a lot in the last probably 5 or 10 years even.
Well, it's funny that you say you do it in training. You ping half volleys to each other in training, but come game day, you don't do it.
Yeah, I know. Next time I play, I might start half volleying and see what happens. But... No, it's like strange. It's such a simple technique, Rich, isn't it? You know, you're 12 yards out and you can put it wherever you want. And it's the same. It's the same kicking it full length for the pitch. It's the same technique, just a little bit quicker.
Do you know what? I think it will come back. And the reason being, the biggest risk with a half volley was you're reliant on the pitch. Yeah. So actually, if anything now, it would be easier to do a half volley now with quality surface rather than 15 years ago when we were doing it, where, I mean, I remember Vicarage Road, it was like Cowfield. You know, you're trying to do a half volley and it's really heavy ground and you're reliant on getting a good bounce. Whereas now that won't be an issue. So I can see the half volley coming back, and I'm sure somebody will get that technique where you can then hit it below head height and have a variation of the side volley if you're putting it in over the top, or a half volley if you're into chest. I still think it's a really valid technique, but I do not know a single goalkeeper, certainly in the Premier League, who still half volleys the ball. It's died out completely, which is extraordinary.
Yeah, it's great. We played against someone recently and they did it, and I remember thinking, wow, I've not seen that for so long. Do you know who it was? It was last season. It was Alan McGregor at Hull.
Yeah, and there's a reason.
He was absolutely launching it.
Yeah.
And I was like, "What? Why? That's the first time I've seen it in a long time, and it was I've not seen it since. Yeah. But, you know, it's, you play to your strengths, and obviously if he's comfortable doing that, then brilliant.
We mentioned school there, Lonis, and actually this is something we touched upon briefly with Frankie Fielding in a recent podcast, and we've not actually gone into that much depth with regards to school. And I remember when I was 14, 15, 16 at school, and the other kids who were on a YTS scheme at the time were going off and leaving class early and getting special dispensation to leave school, and we were all like, God, that's awesome, they've got this amazing life that they're going to be a footballer. What was it like for you managing that in terms of a sacrifice when you're 16 years old and going away to train with clubs but also trying to balance schoolwork?
I'll be honest, I was just wanting to be a footballer. I was decent at school. My mum was really wanting me to do well, my mum and dad, but I got to the age of 14, 15, and obviously being called up for England schoolboys, playing for them, and David Moyes was a manager at Preston, and he used to really look after me every school holiday. I'd be in training with the first team, and I just was a bit sort of short-sighted in a way that I thought I'm always going to be a footballer. So the school stuff really... I disregarded it. I'm not proud of it, but that's what I did. I feel like to be a footballer, you've got to be 100% committed to being a footballer. But that's not saying you can't do well at school and college and what have you. But for me, it was just football and nothing. And luckily, it worked out.
You make a great point. Actually, funnily, it's a conversation I've been having a lot recently. And from a personal point of view as well, like I actually got involved in a lot of business bits and pieces quite early in my career. And genuinely, I regret that now. As much as I'm happy now that I'm retired and I'm moving into different areas and it's paid dividends now. But while I was playing, what you said there is spot on. And if you're going to do something, you're going to do it properly. It's hard to focus on 3, 4, 5 things and do them all at 100%. If you're focused on one thing and you give your life and soul to it, you give yourself a great chance of becoming whatever it is you want to become. The problem with football is that there are no guarantees, and you can do that and you might not make it, and then all of a sudden you're several steps behind a lot of your peers because you might be 18, 19, 20 years old and you've been released by a club, you've got no education to your name, and suddenly you've got to enter the big wide world and try and create a career for yourself. So there is such a risk to it. But at the same time, if you don't make that sacrifice, more often than not, you can find yourself in a position where you don't have that career. And then you're almost, you've got two regrets, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. It does make a lot of sense. I think you don't know how other people work, but my mind, I was so focused and so driven to be a footballer that I couldn't see anything stopping me. And something might well have done out of my control, and I wasn't prepared if that happened. So it's a big risk to take, but I feel that you've got to be 100% in to be a footballer, especially life of a goalkeeper. You've got to work every single day as hard as you can, because if you don't, if I don't work my socks off through the week and I make a mistake on a Saturday, that'll be down to me not putting in the work during the week. That's my thoughts on that.
Well, it all started at Preston, and it was a very young start for you under David Moyes. He handed you your debut at 16 years old. It was a League Cup game against Coventry. Very, very young for a goalkeeper to be in at 16 years old.
Yeah, it was. It was a strange one because it was probably around the August time, so it was just at the beginning of the season. They played Coventry in the first leg of what's the Carabao Cup now. Mm. And I think beat them 3-1 at home. Coventry were a Premier League side. They had Craig Bellamy and the likes. Hadji, do you remember? Is it Mustafa Hadji?
Yeah.
They had some good players. And we went to Coventry for the next leg. And I remember being on the bus and there was me and the goalie coach. So really, I should have thought, I've got a chance of playing. But it never once crossed my mind. I thought, well, he's going to play. He was still a registered player. And got to the ground. I was looking at the pitch and David Moyes says to me, how's the pitch? And I said, yeah, it's class. He said, good, you're playing. And I just remember saying, oh, nice one. And then I just played. It was just like we got beat 4-1. But I remember actually, I know it sounds bad, but at that stage, you don't really have any fear. It was like, well, I couldn't do anything with the goals. And I actually couldn't, looking at it, did everything what I had to do well. Just got beat off a better side. And then the next day, I remember getting back about 2 o'clock in the morning. The next day, I was at the bus stop at 7:30, having to get the bus to the stadium and wash the kit. It was a mad 24 hours.
Obviously, because I know you from the last 15, 20 years or so, but I'm always intrigued by the mentality of different goalkeepers, because we've got every different type of mentality. Some that get really nervous, some not nervous at all. Some need to be really relaxed going into a game. Some need to be quite tense going into a game. But like your reaction there, as soon as David Moyes tells you you're playing, did you get that instant feeling of nerves, or was it simply a case of, oh, thanks, David, go and play the game? Are you quite relaxed about it?
I never got nervous at the time. I was so sure of myself and I was like, I'm going to play soon. And I would have been a million miles away from the level at the time. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. But I just had that confidence, which I wish I still had a bit as I got older, that confidence of, oh yeah, this is me. I should be here. But, you know, I was never nervous. I was buzzing for it at the time. And then I made my league debut the same season. It was against Watford, actually, Rich. And the goalkeeper got injured in the warm-up and I stepped in. And I remember I was probably more nervous throughout the game than I was going into the game, which doesn't happen anymore. Once you kick off, you're fine.
Yeah.
But I remember thinking they had about 20 corners and I was just getting absolutely bullied off Tommy Mooney in these. I was just getting smashed all over the place.
Yeah.
Well, we actually won 3-2. So, it was a good day.
Do you find that you get more nervous now? I mean, you just touched on it there. You wish you kind of had that confidence that you had back then. Do you find that you get a little bit more nervous now for games?
Well, I don't really get nervous. You know what? I've not played much recently. And I went on loan to Rochdale. And I remember my first one, I was driving to the game. And I had like a buzz, an excitement that I've not had in a couple of seasons. I was just buzzing to go and play football. And I just thought, I'm obviously coming towards the end of my career. And I just thought, just go and enjoy it like you used to. Don't worry about anything. And I did. I really enjoyed it.
When you're young and you're getting smashed by those strikers, like you say there, Tommy Mooney and big, you know, old-fashioned strikers who are very strong aerially, are you making sure as a young goalkeeper that you're smashing them back so they know you're there?
I remember that game. I was coming for every single cross. Like, that's the thing. When you're young, you do things. You just think, I'll get that. And as you get older, you pick and choose what you get involved in. But at that time, I just thought I had to come for everything. And I remember just coming and, like, putting the knee in the back of one and then one elbow in me. And it was just like a fight. It was like, what is going on here? You know what I mean? I wish someone had just said, just chill out and let us deal with it, you know, the defenders. But I was like, no, come and get this. Screaming keepers and just getting flattened out.
Well, look, we'll discuss your career at Preston, because it was quite an interesting period that you had there. You made that debut. You talk about the game with Watford. You had to wait a fair while to get your chance, didn't you, for your full league debut to actually play as a permanent goalkeeper?
Yeah, it was after the Watford game. After the Coventry game, after my debut, the goalkeeper coach, Callum O'Hanlon, he was brilliant, and David Moyes, he said to me, oh, you won't be playing much, you might have to wait 2 or 3 years. And I remember thinking, no chance, I'll be in soon. And they were right. The plan they had for me was drawn out, and it was spot on. When I finally got in the team, I was ready. When I made my debut, I was nowhere near ready. Probably weighed about 7 stone. You know what I mean? It was like I was nowhere near it.
Was it Watford game your debut, was it? What, do you know what year that was?
That was 2001. But I played against you, Rich. Remember the first game of the season 1 year? Yeah. That was when we were both like number one keepers. Yeah, we played you first game of the season. Saved a penalty in the 88th minute, Rich, if you remember that one.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, thanks for that.
But no, I remember we both had good games, you know, and it was good to like... But obviously, we knew each other from the England... We went to La Manga, didn't we? You know, when we were probably 17, 18, and just a good time for goalkeeping, for the English goalkeepers, wasn't it? It was me, you, Grant, who was coming through, Campy. It was quite a few of us.
No, it was. I was going to say my other, obviously, memory was, you mentioned La Manga, which we had that great week away. Boaz Myhill as well, if I remember rightly, was involved in that. But then the other one was where we were in the squad together and you played at Upton Park. It was just a friendly. You're right, there was kind of that time. There were a lot, and a lot of the goalkeepers we were involved in those squads have gone on to have good careers.
If that era had been now, I reckon a lot of us would have got really good big moves. You know, the likes of Angus Gunn's getting bought for 30 million from the under 21 setup, and good goalkeeper. But that, the times have changed so much that people are buying young goalkeepers after a few appearances now.
And that's true.
Whereas in our day, it was pretty rare, wasn't it?
Why did you laugh at that when he said Angus Gunn?
No, I laughed at the 13 million just because I went for a free. It wasn't quite the 13 million price tag, unfortunately.
I've had about 10 frees, Rich.
By the way, any tales from La Manga we can share on this podcast?
Was it What Stays in La Manga? No, nothing actually, because all I remember is that it was a week of playing tennis and football. It was like kids on tour, if I remember rightly. We played tennis every night and we played a bit of golf and lots of training. It was a great week away.
Yeah, we were just young lads, and I was quite quiet back in them days, because I felt sort of a bit of an, what do you call it, inferiority complex coming from Preston, who wasn't the biggest of clubs, you know, going in with all the big hitters. I think Reece was at Chelsea at the time, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Rich was at Watford, right. Boaz was at Villa. So I was like quite quiet and like, but I always remember the first time I met Rich. I'm like, he's a good lad, Rich. He's a good lad.
There you go. And then
good keeper as well. Yeah. He talks himself down quite a lot on this podcast. But I think that's just for the humour.
Yeah. To be fair, you mentioned there that's the remark about Angus Gunn. It wasn't too long after that you were quite heavily linked with Arsenal, weren't you? How close was that move to coming off?
No, there was a thing from, maybe 2004. I had quite a bit of interest, and there was a couple of, you know, really, really big clubs that were interested in doing something. And in the January, I think a few offers were made, and Preston sort of agreed to do it at the end of the season because we were pushing for the playoffs. And then in the February, I did my cruciate and sort of ended all hopes of that happening. A bit of a bitter pill to swallow at the time when everything was just on the up constantly, week after week. I just felt, and then back down to earth with a bang.
That mentality to come back from that, I mean, Rich talks a lot about mindset, but you spent about, what was it, 18 months to 2 years on the sidelines as a result of that.
Yeah. I look back, I can't even, it's like it was in a previous life. It seems a lot longer ago. I just got on with it. You know, once you've done it, you've done it. There's no way you can turn back time. And I just remember thinking, right, well, I've got a chance now to, as we said back then, get massive in the gym. And that, you know, so I did like 2 years of just weights, like pure weights, like bodybuilding weights. And I came back training thinking I could just start again where I left off. And I was carrying so much excess weight, muscle, that I couldn't move, you know. So it was like, it was a big learning curve for me, you know. It took me a while to get back to feeling how I felt before the injury.
It's quite an interesting mentality, and I always mention this because we get so many goalkeeper coaches that listen in. But when you do get that injury, one of the biggest things I always advise is to shift your mindset as soon as you can. Like, feel sorry for yourself if you have to for a day, 2 days, a week, 2 weeks. But at some point, you need to shift your mindset to, right, what's the opportunity in this? So, for instance, with me, when I had my broken arm, you know, my legs were fine. So it meant that I worked plyometrics, spring training, kicking. Like, there were certain things I knew I could do. And actually, rather than just ticking along each week and doing bits and pieces, you could really focus in on an area for a period of time to improve that. So the thinking being that when you finally do become fit again, because you will become fit at some point, you're going to be so much stronger coming back because you've hyper-focused in certain areas?
Yeah, definitely. It was difficult. I know now the stuff that a goalkeeper needs. You don't need to be able to bench press 140k. It's pointless. But that's what I was trying to do. Because I couldn't use my leg, do you know what I mean? So I was I was just trying to lift and pull ups and do all this. For me, that's not the right way of training. That's the old school, isn't it? Remember all the old keepers? They were all massive, like, just loved doing weights, and there was no plyometrics then. And I've learned from all that now, and I stay away from the stuff I did then to what I do now.
Well, this is a little equation for our goalkeepers out there. It's flexibility plus strength equals power. So the whole idea is, it's all good and well getting the strength, but if you haven't got the flexibility, then you're not going to be any more powerful. And if anything, the bulkier you are, of course, it's going to be harder to move. I mean, if you did your knee again, and touch wood you don't, but if you did your knee again and you had to have a few months on the sidelines, what kind of thing could you focus on to help you improved when you come back? Obviously, you mentioned that weights didn't really do it for you because it just made you bulkier. Would it be more of the things away from football? Would it maybe be a yoga, Pilates and stuff like that?
Yeah, it would. I'm a big fan. I don't do it as much as I can because it's quite a trip for me to get there. But the hot yoga, I think, is one of the best things you could do as a goalkeeper. Mm. I think for your body and your mind as well, you know, you come out of one of them classes and you just feel so relaxed and calm. I think I'd focus a lot more on the stretching and the core side of things than actually lifting big weights. Yeah. 100% I'd do that.
By the way, I'm absolutely hooked on hot yoga at the moment. I'm going like 5 times a week. It's the life of any ex-goalkeeper, just to keep the body moving. Yeah, WD-40 for the joints it is.
Yeah, it is. It's unbelievable, the feeling you get from it. Like, where I live in Preston, there's one that's about 30 minutes away, and the class is full at like 5, 6 in the evening. And I've got 2 children and after-school clubs and all this. It's quite hard to get to. But you know, I try and recreate it a bit myself. I put a few layers on and do a bit of stretching, but it's not the same, is it?
Not quite.
You know?
It's funny that when you think of massive goalkeepers, because there's that Stuart Tomlinson, isn't there? The one who went to WWE.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Absolute tank of a man.
Yeah.
How did you get about the goal?
Obviously, I was nothing like that. I'm quite lean, you know, quite like long-limbed and slim. But for me, I was carrying excess muscle. And I found 1v1, I'd be brilliant. The ball would just hit me. And I'd be like, happy days. But when you had to move, you know, like trying to reach in top corner, I had lats like that were just, I couldn't even get my arms up. It was unbelievable.
I think there's this balance between, like, managers want to see a presence. They love that word, presence in goals. They want to see the big 6'5" tall, 6'5" wide goalkeeper. You know, that's what they want to see. But the reality is what you are, is tall, lean. I mean, you look at a lot of the top goalkeepers now, your Ter Stegens, David De Gea, they're all a similar shape, you see, because it is that speed, flexibility, power. It's not the bulk. The bulk might look great, but as you've just touched upon there, in order to maximise your game, it's all about speed.
100%, mate. I think this is another thing. Like, I think De Gea was the one, when he first came, everyone was like, he needs to beef up. But he was probably a teenager, was he 19?
Yeah,
when he came.
So young, yeah.
And it's a completely different game. If you watch Spanish football, I remember when he played at West Brom, one of his first games, and he was getting tortured. And it's just completely different. And you look at him now, and I've got a similar build to him. That's the ideal keeper now, I think, to Stegen, him. The big, bulky one, like you said, I think managers going away from that, all look at him, great presence to that speed and agility.
Post-injury, you then establish yourself back at Preston, Player of the Year, successive seasons in 2009 and 2010. There was then a period where you played some pretty incredible games, or you were involved in some pretty eventful games. There's three in particular that I'd quite like to talk about that were right in a short space of time over the course of a couple of seasons. First one was the game against Cardiff, where you won 6-0 and actually overturned a goal difference deficit, didn't you? So you actually got into the playoffs instead of them. You saved a penalty in that game. The second one was the Burnley game, where you were 3-1 up and lost 4-3.
Yeah.
We'll come on to why that one's significant. and the third one was the Leeds game, where I believe you were 4-1 down and you won 6-4. Mad games to be involved in.
Not the best for a goalkeeper, really. The first one was a good one. The Cardiff game was brilliant because we just went on. You know, they talk about momentum at this time of the season, and we won our last 4 games, and we ended up getting in the playoffs by 1 goal over Cardiff, and we just beat them 6-0. So that was a good time. The Burnley one, try and forget about that, to be honest.
So, I mean, listen, it's one of those things, isn't it, that it courted a bit of controversy at the time. For the listeners, we'll just say that you basically made a gesture towards the fans. It was picked up on camera, and you were then fined £5,000 for doing that, and I guess it's something that you learnt from. What was going through your head when you did that? Was that just pure rage at the fact that you were winning the game? It was against local rivals. You then lost the game towards the end of the match. Just tension spilled over.
Yeah, I was raging with the game because we were 3-1 up, and then we definitely had one man sent off. Billy Jones got sent off, and I'm sure we had another man sent off. And it was just, you could see it coming. We went down to 10 men But I was giving a bit of stick to the Burnley fans at 3-1 because they hated me. They absolutely hated me. So I was giving them all the stick. And then they scored the second. And I'm like, I best rein it in a bit. And I remember looking at the clock at 85 minutes. I thought, nah, they're getting it. So I was giving it them back. And then they scored again. But just previous to that, I'd gone to get the ball. When the ball went into the crowd, I'd gone to get it and they're keeping hold of it like they do. And a couple of them spat at me and one of them actually like hit me in the face. And that just made me lose it. And I couldn't get that out of my head. You can say whatever you want, but when someone spits at you, yeah, it's disgusting. Yeah. They got it on camera at the FA when I went for my hearing. And one of the panel was like, I totally agree with your reaction. He spat at you. And the other two were like, nah, there's no need. It's embarrassing, really, to look back on my behaviour. But these things happen.
Is it something that you now don't think about doing in terms of having banter with fans? We often ask goalkeepers this about the fact that you're closest to the fans and you can have a bit of banter with home fans and away fans. Do you still, after that experience, were you like, I'm never doing that again? I'm never going to have banter with them before the game is finished?
I've done it a few times, like, but I made sure we were like 3-0 up. I mean, playing for Leeds against Bristol last year, and I was getting a bit of abuse, and it always seems to be the same person at Bristol every time we're playing, but I always get good results there. And it was on and on and on, and we were 3-0 up, and there was about 30 seconds left. I thought, right, he's getting it now. So I just turned around, and only really like friendly banter, like telling me how bad I am, you're crap, you're this, you're that. I says, if I'm bad, what are you lot? We're beating you 3-0. Then he just lost his head. So, I try and rein it in now, because as soon as you pipe up, you get knocked down, don't you?
What's that like with strikers as well? Do goalkeepers get involved with strikers in terms of banter when you're up for corners and that, you know, you're stamping on each other in the box? Is there a bit of an exchange in those scenarios?
Yeah, there is. But do you know what? You get one or two that are really serious with it. You know, they'll try and mug you off and give you grief. But it just makes me laugh most of the time. And I think they're quite a good lad, strikers. If you make a good save off them, they're first to tap you on the back and say, great save, you know. Just as if someone whacked one past me in the top corner and he stood by me in a corner, I'd say to him, great goal, mate. That's just how I play.
We're going to move on to managers, because obviously this period for you at Preston was good. Alan Irvine was the manager at the time, said you could have played for England. Darren Ferguson, I believe the season after, was valuing you at, you know, £20 million, which we're talking record-breaking figures at the time for an English goalkeeper, had you moved. But then Phil Brown came in and it all changed. New manager, different outlook. There was the loan deal involving Ian Turner at Everton, which was quite a strange scenario because you went to Everton, right, as part of that deal to train with them. What must have that been like for you? Because you were a first-choice goalkeeper and then they brought in a keeper to, I guess, compete with you. But you ended up going to Everton in his place to train with the club.
Yeah, it was a strange one because me and Phil Brown, we didn't see eye to eye. I have no problem saying it because I'm not telling lies. It was the January. I think I played like 147 games in a row for Preston and they denied me a few moves, which I was upset about, you know, moving to the Premier League, and I was thinking I'd missed my chance. And I think Cardiff came in for me on deadline day in the January, and I remember sitting down with Phil on deadline day saying, look, we need to do this because Cardiff were top of the league. We were bottom. And he just said, you can't go. He said, you're one of the most important players, you know, the usual. And that was that. The deadline was that evening. We had a game that evening, so it never got done. And then a week later, he pulls me and tells me that I'd been at the club too long and I needed to move on. So it was like, wow, the window's shut. I couldn't do anything. So obviously, he wanted Ian Turner, and David Moyes said for me to go to Everton, but the window was shut, so nothing could be done. Yeah, I just went and trained with them and sat on the bench for Preston at the weekends.
This is a completely different conversation, but it's... You hear stories like this, and I guess I always like to ask goalkeepers this, as to what they would have done differently, because you did have several opportunities. Like, you know, I remember throughout my career, I was always hearing of all these different rumours. You were in the papers regularly about being linked with X, Y and Z. Of course, nothing did come off to the Premier League. Do you have any regrets? Would you have acted differently in any of the situations, tried to force it more your end, or do you think it was what it was?
Yeah.
And it wasn't, you know, just wasn't meant to be?
No, I think I'd handle it differently. I mean, it sounds bad, but as sometimes, you know, when the deal's right for everybody, which a few of them were, and I was sort of told, oh, the club's going to move in this direction. I remember saying to the manager at the time, this is as far as Preston can go. We were punching well above our weight. I think I would have done things differently, yeah. I'd have been a lot more selfish. I wouldn't have gone along with what they were saying. I'd have forced it through, and it's easy to say now. But if it happened again, that's the way I go about it, because I think denying someone that opportunity who's been at the club since he was 8 or 9,
yeah,
I think was the wrong thing to do.
Do you know what? It's an interesting subject. And I'll just mention one here. In fact, a lad that we both know very well, Mike Williamson, who had his move. He came to Watford and ended up, of course, playing for Newcastle for a long period of time. But between Watford and Newcastle, he went to Portsmouth. And I'll always remember it. He got a bit of stick from Watford fans because on deadline day, knew there was interest from Portsmouth. And let's just say he did all he had to do in order to force the move through, which didn't go down well with Watford fans, didn't go down well, particularly with the manager at the time. But then he's gone from Portsmouth to Newcastle, ended up playing 150 games in the Premier League, having a fantastic career and everything else that comes with it. And then you look at like the alternative of someone that sticks around because they're the good lad, you know. And a good example I remember was Richard Johnson at Watford, could have gone to Leeds United, if I remember rightly, for $4 million. The club said no, wait until the end of the season, then gets a cruciate knee injury, never plays the game again, you know, and you miss out on that opportunity. Now, I'm not saying that players should force their way out, but there is so many different sides to every story. And I think what fans don't realize a lot of the time is that the potential to have a move like that, that could be a life-changing move, both from a personal perspective, in terms of the finances that are involved, of course, but then also from the point of a career perspective, you do get to play in the Premier League. These opportunities don't come around all the time. The other side of it being that fans are very quick to forget a player. You know, it's all good and well. If you're not in the team and you get released, then yeah, they clap you on your way and say well done. But it's the moment you leave because they don't want you to leave, they can be really upset by that. It's a subject that fascinates me because I don't think it's one that's discussed necessarily from the player's point of view that often.
It's a difficult one. I mean, like I say, if everything's right and you believe that that is the right thing, I mean, there's no good kicking off if someone's trying to get you on the cheap and they've been in 20, 30 grand for you and they want 3 million. You know, that's not going to happen. But when the club sets a fee and the buying club meets it and then the club changed the fee last minute, that's when I should have been stronger and done what Mike did. I know the story. I used to live with Mike when we were at Wolves and he was telling me, and I wish I had a piece of that in me, but I didn't at the time. You know, I was one of them guys just going along with things, you know, didn't want to upset people and what have you, but, you know, perhaps I played that one wrong.
It's that relationship with managers as well that I find quite fascinating because it's obviously crucial. It's massive for your relationship with the guy that's going to be picking you. And, you know, you went to Leeds and you were first choice there. You were loving it, a new lease of life at Elland Road. And then Neil Warnock came in to replace Simon Grayson, who was the manager at the time when you moved there. Neil Warnock came in, brought in Paddy Kenny, as he did with pretty much every club that he went to. So then, you know, you moved on. So that relationship that you have with managers, I mean, I remember you saying with Billy Davies at Preston, you were out injured for a long time and he didn't really talk to you that much. Dougie Friedman at Bolton said that you were his number one for a period, but brought back Adam Bogdan to replace you. And then he became first choice again. Paul Lambert at Wolves, I believe it was sort of on and off with. So that relationship you have with managers is so crucial, isn't it?
Yeah, the managers you spoke about there, I think the Billy Davies one, I think I said that. I was only a young lad and I said that a bit out of frustration. Being in the game so long now, you know when you're injured, the manager's got other priorities. It's not all about you. So that was a bit of a throwaway comment I made then. But the rest of them, like Neil Warnock was bang on with me. Absolute bang on. He pulled me at the end of the season. I think I played nearly every game. I had a broken finger for a few. But and Warnock was like, look, if it wasn't Paddy Kenny, you'd be my number one. And I'm like, fair enough. He was honest. It was straight out there. He said, we've had four offers. Which one do you want to go to? I was like, I want to go to Bolton. And it happened basically in 24 hours. And if someone's honest with you, like he was, you know, you can't complain.
You hear a lot about Neil Warnock. Some people love him. Some people don't love him that much. What was your interpretation of him as a manager and a guy to work with?
I liked him. He is what he is. He's what you see on, that's him. What you see on the, in the press, on the telly, that's him. He's really passionate. He's really, but he looks after you. If you do well for him and you try your best, he's a top man. I can see people not liking him, but they'll be the ones that don't put the shift in and he'll get onto him. But I think that's, someone's not pulling the weight they need telling, and he's not frightened to tell you. He's not frightened at all to tell you. But I really liked him. I thought he was quality.
Obviously, you went to Bolton there. You went as a number two. Is that correct, initially?
Yeah, obviously, they got relegated out of the Premier League, and Owen Coyle was there with Phil Hughes, the goalkeeper coach. And there was a bit of interest when I was at Preston from them when they went up with Burnley. So I knew they quite liked me. And then when Jaskalainen left, Phil, the goalkeeper coach, was on to me about going there. And I think Adam had just won player of the year for Bolton when they went down. But I've not seen much of Bogdan, so I thought I really fancied my chances. And when I got there, I was surprised. He's actually a real top keeper. Great lad and a real top keeper at the time. So it was bide my time. And he started picking up a few niggles and I'd get in and then play well for a bit and then make a mistake. And then Adam would come back and it was just like, that's how it was. I think for three seasons, we played the same amount of games each in three seasons. So it was pretty much a split of who was going to play.
I mean, we talked to Joe Hart a bit about this in one of the earlier podcasts in terms of when you're a number one goalkeeper and that's what you're used to. What's that challenge like to then think, okay, I'm not a shoo-in to be in the starting lineup here. I've got to maybe adjust my game. I've got to do things differently, or I've just got to hope that, you know, and you never hope that someone gets injured. But like you say there, Adam Bogdan picked up a couple of niggling injuries and then that paved the way for you to go in.
Yeah, it's a funny one because up until that point, I was playing all the time. I was almost guaranteed to play when I was fit. So I went there and obviously it was a step above. We'd just come out of the Premier League and everything, the training facility, the standard of play, it was a step above. And I thought, I need to raise my game. When I go to a new club, I want to prove to the lads in the dressing room that I'm good enough. That's my first thing. I knew I wasn't going to start the season. But Adam was outstanding. You know, he gets quite a bit of stick, Bogdan. But for me, he's one of the best keepers I've seen. You know, it was great to work with him.
You also had a concussion at Bolton.
What? That finished me off, that.
I mean, in what sense? In terms
I actually
of
finished, my, finished my Bolton career. I never played again after that.
Really? But what happened? Yeah. How did the concussion occur?
I was playing Nottingham Forest and Dean Moxie, like a good mate of mine, saw me short of a back. I think it was a header. Yeah, headed it back. And I've come out to pick it up and like to scoop it. And as I've gone down, I think Dexter Blackstock just ran into me. And next thing, I woke up in hospital. Like, I'm thinking, what is going on? I was out for about 3 or 4 weeks. That was a nasty one. I did, you know, when people get a concussion, I think, you just bang your head, you're all right. But it was quite a severe one. And then my contract was up, so I left Bolton at that time because obviously the financial difficulties were making it. It's all come to light now, but they were rumbling then about how much in trouble they were. So I had to leave, really.
Yeah, it's such a shame to see what's going on at the club now.
It was a great club at the time. It was a great place to be.
Yeah, you mentioned the concussion. I don't know, similar to you, mine was, I had a really bad one with Paul Furlong. Again, I have no recollection of this at all, but I think I came up for a cross and he's either headbutted me or elbowed me. And I don't remember the day at all. And I was out for a few minutes, hospital, all that kind of stuff. But it's more that I'm seeing lately, all the different things that are coming out about concussion. And of course, the NFL being a big thing at the moment. Does that worry you at all? Have you looked into any of that?
I'm a big fan of like the UFC, like MMA. And there's a big thing there in America about the concussions and boxing and how it's affecting them. CTE, do we call it, you know. Mm. I'm thinking that's a completely different game. You know, I took one serious blow to the head in 20 years, so I think I'll be all right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Especially trying to come back too early from it. But the doctors at the clubs are bang. They've got a protocol that they follow, you know, step by step. And, you know, it's not something I worry about, to be honest with you.
Moving on to present day, of course, you're at Middlesbrough at the moment, so keen to know how that's gone so far for you and obviously working with Jonathan Gould, who's your current goalkeeper coach, and also what the next step is for you going forward, how much longer you're planning to play for, have you got plans after retirement?
Yeah, firstly, the Middlesbrough thing, I've played 2 League Cup games, so, you know, people would probably be expecting to say it's not going well, but I love it, it's an absolutely brilliant club. I'm working with Gouldy, who I played with at Preston a long time ago, and you know, the goalkeepers I'm working with, Big Dim, he's 40 years of age and he trains every single day. He trains, works really hard, good guy. And then you've got Darren Randolph, who is, in my eyes, easily the best goalkeeper in this league. Easily. Just no one comes near him. He's outstanding. So it's a good group to be involved in.
It's funny you mentioned that, actually. I've just realised it was Gouldy. I was thinking, did I make my debut against you? It wasn't. I made my debut against Jonathan Gould for Preston, because my debut was against Preston, then my 5th ever game was against Preston, and that was against yourself. So there you go, another nice little link. I was racking my brain earlier. I thought, did you play in that first one? But you didn't.
Was that on a Tuesday night, Rich?
Yeah, Tuesday Vicarage night, Vicarage Road.
I was on the bench for that. Okay. I'm sure it was pouring down. Freezing, one of the two.
Yeah, Sean Dyche got sent off. That. You guys won 1-1-0. There you go. See, all sorts of links we've got, mate. What about the plan for the next step then? I take it you're going to plan to play for as long as you possibly can. Is that very much the goal? And then have you had any thoughts as to what you'll move into next? Will you stay in the goalkeeping world?
Yeah, obviously I want to play. Like, I've not missed a day's training in years. You know what I mean? I train every day. I'm fit. I'm healthy. I just want to enjoy it. The day I stop enjoying it will be the day I pack in. But at the moment, I love it. I want to be a goalkeeper coach, whether that be academy, you know, 16 to 21 age or first team. That's probably what I want to do after football.
Fantastic. And the last question, given that you're a regular, listen to our podcast, and you mentioned off air, actually, that you've listened to every single podcast so far. Is that right?
Listen to all of them, mate.
Absolutely brilliant. I'd love to hear that.
I find myself like talking to you, Bob, going, yeah, I agree with the right what they're saying. I agree with that. I'm like losing my rag.
Yeah,
I want to have a, you know, like thinking like about the pundits and that. I'm just like, yeah, come on.
Great stuff. Well, you'll know what our last question is then. We always ask this to all of the goalkeepers that we speak to. I mean, you've been a professional goalkeeper for a long time. You've been a goalkeeper since you were a child. What has goalkeeping given you?
It's given me everything, hasn't it? It's given me a life. It's given me a life to live, you know, a proper purpose. It's brilliant. It's given me everything. That's all I can say.
Absolutely fantastic. Well, I think we're off to do a spot of hot yoga, Rich and I.
On a genuine note, I mean, any goalkeepers listening in, and in fact, two people that I know that did yoga. One, of course, Ryan Giggs was well known for it. The other one, I might have mentioned this before, but Brad Friedel, first ever day I went into Blackburn Rovers, he gave me a book, Real Men Do Yoga. Absolutely ignored the book, never looked at it. But there's a reason that these players go on till they're in their 40s. Like, to be able to do that, it balances you out a little bit. And in fact, I'll ask you, Lonas, whether that's the case. But, you know, you think of all the intensive work you do as a goalkeeper, up, down, all the weight training, plyometrics, speed training. Sometimes it's more for the mind as much as it is for the body.
The benefits for your body are there, you know, if you're doing the yoga and you're flexible. But the mind, I think, if you can relax yourself and concentrate on your breathing and just focus on what you're doing for that 60 or 90 minutes, I think it's so helpful for you. You know, it's so easy to switch off in life today, isn't it? It's hard to concentrate. There's all sorts going on. If you can just zone out for 60 minutes, I think it does you the world of good.
I fully agree.
Which is exactly what people will do when they listen to this podcast, yeah, hopefully. Just zone right
bloody
out. Andrew Lonergan, thank you very much for joining us.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
That was Lonas, mate. Top boy.
Yeah, he's a good lad. I do like Lonas.
I thoroughly enjoyed the stories that you two shared with us.
Oh, I hope the listener did as well. We were just reminiscing for about 15 minutes there.
A few bits from that. The one that struck me, I think, most was the fact that he went on loan to Everton towards the end of his Preston career, as he was explaining. They brought in Ian Turner, who was a young Everton goalkeeper at the time. Lonergan went to Everton and trained with Everton throughout the week, but then would come back on the weekends and sit on Preston's bench. I find that incredible.
Yeah, it's bizarre. Well, and he touched on it, and that was part of that, that he obviously had several opportunities to move away, and it never quite happened. Of course, he's well thought of at Preston and did brilliantly there, several player of the seasons, if I remember rightly. But it's interesting, and this isn't just Andrew Lonergan. This is everybody, to an extent, where opportunities come up, and Lonas said himself there that he wished he'd have pushed a little bit harder at times because he could have played in the Premier League for a long, long time. I'm sure he could have. He was always the top goalkeeper as we came through the age groups. And I remember, obviously, I was in contact with him and I was at Watford at the time. He was at Preston, but he was flying week after week. He touched on it there. It was strength to strength to strength. And you thought he is destined to play 100, 200, 300 games in the Premier League. Didn't quite happen. Now, he still had a fantastic career and he's amassed a massive number of games and been a key part of many teams. But it does just make you think, when those opportunities come up, whether it be as a footballer or in other walks of life, how can you make the most? How can you grasp those opportunities? Because they don't come up all the time and things can change so quickly, as is the case, as you mentioned, with Phil Brown, where one week he's close to getting a move and then the next week, apparently he's spent too long at the club and needs to move on. But that's not just football, that's everything. When those opportunities come up, can you find a way to take them?
It's that loyalty as well, isn't it? And this is something we talked about with Dean Kiley.
Yeah.
We used the word mercenary, ruthless. The fact that some footballers might turn around and think, okay, well, maybe I need to show some loyalty. But really, he's missed out on an opportunity to play in the Premier League.
Here's my point. Who cares? That's my point. Without sounding harsh, like, of course, players care for the club. But this is the problem with football to an extent, in that the fans love you when you're playing well. Now, what happens when you get dropped and you're not playing so well? They can't wait to move you on. And then you'll return a year later and you'll get a standing ovation because you were the good lad that stuck there and lost out on massive moves. But the second they didn't want you, they let you move on. They give you a nice ovation when you come back. Well, the player loses out. Well, what happens the other way? When actually you force your move and you go away, okay, you come back and the fans boo you, but you may well have set yourself up for life. You may well now be playing in the Premier League. And actually, when it comes down to it, does it matter? when it comes down to the individual, you have to be selfish at times. And people might not necessarily like you for it, but is it because you're a bad person or is it because they've got loyalties towards that football club? I just think that if that opportunity comes, if it's the right opportunity, it's the right time. And exactly like Lon has said, if it works for all parties, you need to find a way of making it happen. It's easier said than done, but you need to find a way. Otherwise, you might regret it.
And it's not just fans either. It's managers. In his case, obviously, you know, you're signing a new contract. A manager's convinced you to sign a new contract. You do that. He then gets the sack. A new guy comes in and replaces you.
It's so fickle, football. It changes by the minute. You know, managers come and go and they will tell you what they say. But this is one of the issues where everyone has an agenda in football. A manager's agenda isn't necessarily the individual. It might be themselves. It might be they want to keep their job and they want to keep the best possible players. The CEO, he wants to make sure that he's getting the best possible price for you. He sees you as a number on a piece of paper. It might be the physio. Their agenda is to keep everybody fit for as long as they possibly can and make sure that 90% of the players are out training all the time. And this is where, as players, you need to understand that your agenda needs to be you. It sounds selfish, but it needs to be you and your progression, your career path. And, you know, some people won't like it. You can't please everybody all the time.
Top stuff. Well, lastly, that Andrew Lonergan goal that we mentioned right at the top of the show, going to put that up on our Twitter so people do have a watch, because it features probably the most unenthusiastic bit of commentary I've ever heard in my life. For a goalkeeper to score a goal and the commentator, sensational goal, brilliant.
Yeah.
Well worth a listen.
Yeah, no, it was. It's, I would fully agree with you there.
Well, that is another podcast down, my friend.
It is another great one, and we've got some big guests again coming in the next few weeks. And as always, I see our listening figures are going up every single week. So I can only thank you so much for being as involved as you are and continuing to spread the word. I've mentioned this the last couple of weeks, and things are going on behind the scenes as well. A set of audiobooks are set to be released very soon, so do keep an eye out for them. We've got several other plans as well. But we will be continuing with these podcasts week in, week out, and we've got some big, big guests in the coming weeks.
Big, big guests, he says. Who we got?
Can't reveal that, can we, Mr. Beadle?
And also reviews. You didn't mention reviews. Please do write some reviews for us, because we would love to read them and we will put them on the show. So your name could be mentioned alongside the likes of Richard Lee on this podcast.
Oh, what a privilege.
As always, if you want to get in touch, on Twitter at GK Union, on Instagram at GK Union Official, just search GK Union on Facebook. Or drop us an email, hello@goalkeepersunion.net. It's the Goalkeepers Union podcast in association with GK Icon.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.